Right. Thank you very much for the introduction and for the invitation. So I was asked to come here and give you a very short introduction to algorithms. Now, 10 years ago, the word algorithms was considered very esoteric. You wouldn't sort of find it appearing in a newspaper. These days, you find it everywhere, and my daughter comes home from primary school saying, we've learned about algorithms. I want to tell you about them. So now the story of algorithms starts with this man, who you probably don't recognize. This is, by the way, Muhammad bin Musa al-Khwarizmi, who was in the early 9th century a scholar at the Bayt al-Hikma in Baghdad, which I reckon is the greatest center of learning before the founding of Cambridge. Now, why do we start with him? Well, a Latin translation of his work, there are several works of his, but was what popularized in medieval Europe what came to be called Arabic numerals. He didn't call them that. But it was largely the result of his work. The reason why they're popular is because it made adding and multiplying numbers much easier than working with Roman numerals, and certainly possibly easier than with an abacus. And so the process of adding and multiplying Arabic numerals came to be called the algorithmic method, algorithm being the Latinized version of his name, Al-Khwarizmi. So now you all learned the algorithmic method in primary school, even if it wasn't called that back then. This, by the way, is an illustration from a medieval manuscript showing they actually had these a contest between an algorist and an abacist on who can do arithmetic faster. But how fast is the algorist? That's the sort of question that we want to ask. Okay, so you all learned the algorithmic method. Now, in the 20th century, the word algorithm came to mean, more abstractly, any sort of step-by-step procedure which can be finitely described, but which can work for an infinite collection of possible inputs, right? The process you learn for adding numbers works whether you're adding 10-digit numbers or 100-digit numbers or 20,000-digit numbers. It might get a bit tiring, okay? So, well, you all know how to add numbers. I'm not going to run through this, right? So you work right to left during the carry. You can multiply numbers. I can represent it by some kind of tabular procedure. The point I want to make here is, if you're adding two 100-digit numbers, it takes about 100 single-digit operations. You all know that, right? One for each column. But if you're multiplying 200-digit numbers using this method, you're performing about 10,000 single-digit operations, right? For each pair from each of the 200-digit numbers, you're going to do a single multiplication, okay? So what we say is that the addition algorithm has linear time complexity, and that means that the number of operations grows as a proportion, in proportion to the size of the problem, right? In proportion to the size of the numbers you're adding. Multiplication is of quadratic complexity. The number of single-digit operations you have to do grows roughly as the square of the size of the problem. Depends upon how you exactly define the problem, but that's why we say it's one's linear, one's quadratic. Okay? Note I say the multiplication algorithm is quadratic, but how do we know there isn't a faster way to do multiplication? Well, actually, there is. Okay, Al-Khwarizmi was not the end of the story. People have been coming up with faster ways of doing multiplication, which we can quantifiably faster. As recently, there's been breakthroughs on this, as recently as 4 or 5 years ago. Okay, fundamentally, asymptotically faster methods. So, I've not put any equations on here, so I'm not going to give you the exact asymptotics of the recent. Essentially, based on fast Fourier methods, we can do what we would say is n log n operations, which is much better than n squared, right, when n is the number of digits. So you can reduce the number of multiplications at the cost of doing extra additions. Now, there's an extra cost involved, so it becomes effective to deploy these methods only when the numbers you're multiplying are very, very big. You have to get into the tens of thousands of digits. For the fastest ones we know, the fastest only in theory, because the overheads on any reasonable size numbers are too big. But let me ask you another question. Can multiplication be done by a linear algorithm? That is, where the number of operations grows in proportion to the number of digits you're multiplying. And the answer is we don't know. We don't have any algorithm that works, say, as fast as addition, a linear one. But at least it's not been proved impossible. And that's where I think the, you know, my own interest is in some sense in determining what the ultimate limits are. What can we prove is ultimately impossible. Okay. So now, generally in the field of algorithms, I mean, we're not doing addition and multiplication. We're deploying algorithms for all kinds of other uses. And the point is that we describe the algorithms at a level of abstraction, which is somewhat removed from the specifics of the data involved. So in particular, for you know, we do a lot of work in, let's say, graph algorithms. So a graph is just a collection of elements with their pairwise connectivity represented in some way. Okay, some picture like this, which I just pulled out of a program which was running on my computer. Don't worry about what it represents. The point is that this kind of object, where you have individual elements pairwise connected in some form or another, appears in data sets in all kinds of ways, right? It could be people in a social network. It could be pixels in an image. It could be neurons in the brain. It could be data points in any one of the graphs or charts we have seen in the earlier talk. This kind of thing appears all over the place, and we ask questions, questions we want to solve algorithmically about this. I mean, I just picked a couple of things completely random. For instance, can you take a graph and assign the elements into six different bins so that things in the same bin are not pairwise connected? Now, how do you do this while examining the data? How does your algorithm perform in terms of the number of operations you need to do as the size of the data grows? More importantly, what are the limits? You know, what do we know about the ultimate limits of how fast an algorithm is at all possible, etc.? Those are the kinds of questions we ask. I just picked another typical problem. Now, if I haven't got this on the slide, but the last speaker said something about NP-hard problems. That is, in fact, an NP-hard problem. So the best algorithms we know grow exponentially. The number of operations grows exponentially in the size of the data, which is much worse than the things we've considered. And in the context of big data, when you're performing operations on gigabytes, terabytes of data, an exponential time algorithm is simply inconceivable as something you would want to run. Okay, but there are many, many parameters you can tune here to fine-tune to get the algorithms to work, and it's studying them at this abstract level, right, where you forget about the actual what the data represents and ask abstract questions of this form and try and pin down their complexity, which is what we do. So the point, I mean, this is in some sense a summary slide. There's a rich theory analyzing the complexity algorithms from the point of view of different kinds of resources that are used. So far, in my examples, I talked about the number of operations you need to perform in executing an algorithm. But those are not the only kinds of, that's not the only kind of resource. Any kind of resource that is used which you quantify, you can then analyze an algorithm from the point of view. So computational resources refers to the kinds of things I'm talking about. The number of operations or the amount of memory space or, well, whatever you choose to quantify, but there are also statistical resources. You may, in the kinds of, say, clustering, classification, regression, fitting algorithms, there may be questions of sample size or other such statistical resources. And there are, again, questions of how much resource do you need fundamentally to be able to solve a particular problem. Physical resources, energy, for example. Okay, and I could carry on. So the point is there's a rich theory for analyzing the complexity of algorithms from various points of view. A large part of the theory is aimed at developing new, more efficient algorithms, often in the sense of, well, we've established that a problem is hard. Maybe if we restrict the parameters in some way, there are efficient ways of solving it. You know, if, this problem, the best algorithms we have are exponential, but maybe if you restrict your graphs to ones where every element is connected to at most 10 others, there is an efficient way of doing it. etc. Okay. So we're looking for more efficient algorithms, often by fine-tuning the many different parameters to the problem. But we are also trying to establish the limitations of the algorithmic methods by establishing what we call complexity lower bounds. Okay, that is real impossibility results. That is much harder to do, right? It's about understanding the structure of the problem you're trying to solve rather than looking at particular algorithms for solving it. Now, I'm at the end of the talk, but I went through it with a sort of fine-tooth comb looking for any terms which would incur Arya's penalty. And these bits got stuck in the comb and the sort of are left at the end of the talk. I wanted to say, you know, when we're classifying these different resources, there are many different kind of growth functions, etc. And these are just the kinds of things we think about. But I'll stop there.